Welcome to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with Opera Holland Park's Director of Opera, James Clutton. In conversation with creatives and collaborators, we explore the process of putting opera on stage and how the artists involved approach their craft.
Hello, welcome to From the Producer's Office. I'm James Clutton, Director of Opera at Opera Holland Park. Today I've got with me a great guest, a great friend of mine, one of the great singers, the very, very wonderful Stuart Skelton. How are you doing, Stu?
Mate, it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm extremely well. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I just said that. It's bloody just nice to see you. We're doing this on Zoom today. It's just nice to see you. It's like across the countries and just seeing you. And you look very fit and well and everything. And you're doing some work in the minute, which we'll come back to later, because yep. I'm really interested to see that. But we'll talk about your sort of career as we go on and off. But firstly, let's go right back to the beginning. Sure, I always ask anyone that's on here with me as a guest the first time, was there classical music, opera, singing at any level in your family when you were a kid growing up?
No, there wasn't. My first exposure to anything that wasn't popular music was when I started going to school. I went from the age of, I want to say eight, I don't remember, a while ago, to St. Andrew's Cathedral School, which is the head of the Church of England in Australia. And there's a cathedral school attached to it. And I was a choir boy. Mm. That was my first experience of anything that wasn't what my parents listened to on records when they had dinner parties. So, I mean, my memories of music before that were my mum and dad listening, particularly my dad, listening to Neil Diamond, Hot August Night, you know, and Live at the Greek, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So I grew up on that. But my first exposure to not popular music was 19th century English church music. Right. When I was 15, I went to some rehearsals at what was then the Australian Opera, Opera Australia. And they were doing a new production of Dialogues of the Carmelites with Joan Sutherland as the new prioress, conducted by Richard Bonning. And on alternate days, there was Aida with either Rita Hunter or Marilyn Schau. and then out of nowhere, this something cracked inside me.
It's just amazing though, isn't it? But to even just go there, okay, it's you know, obviously, particularly in Australia, but worldwide, you know, Sutherland, Bonning, amazingly big, famous names, but still to get that impetus to go. What was that impetus to actually go to see something?
Well, it's interesting. In Australia at the time, I don't know if this is still true, when you got to year 10, so your opportunity to leave at the intermediate school level rather than go and matriculate to university, which was another 2 years of high school, we had this thing called work experience, where you had to have a week, and you had to go and find yourself a job for a week, and that was part of the curriculum in anything that you thought might be interesting. And by this stage, I was pretty immersed in 19th century church music, and you know, I was heavily involved in advanced music studies at high school. So I'd have been exposed by that stage to a lot more than just English cathedral music. And a dear mate of mine, one of my best mates at school, Stuart Austin, his dad is Anson Austin. And Anson was one of Australian Opera's principal tenors for a very, very long time.
Right.
And I called Mr. Austin, you know, as he was at the time, and said, I'm thinking about doing my work experience with the opera company for a week. And he said, leave it with me. And he gave me a phone number to call, and I called Ruth Yateman. And, you know, a month later, I'm doing a week at the Sydney Opera House. Bonning was conducting two things. He was doing the Dialogue to the Carmelites with Joan, and a new production of Marriage of Figaro with Glynis Fowles as the Countess, and with directed by John Copley.
Right.
So, you know, it was all, I mean, and I had no idea who any of these people were, understand. So, you know, I was like, John Copley called me Bruce for the entire week.
Fantastic.
I don't know. And I had no idea who any of these people were, apart from Sutherland, obviously. I knew who Sutherland was, but everyone else, Dot, we didn't really have a concept of who they were. And then I watched rehearsal after rehearsal during the day and performances at night. And it was just gobsmacking that music could do to you what it did. And I got it when I was listening to orchestral stuff as part of this, as being a student at school. But hearing live voices on a stage in a production was something that I just didn't have any concept of what that could do to you.
Yeah, that's incredible. I mean, what an introduction like that. I mean, I love John and Richard, but I mean, I wouldn't like to guess at how much work got done in that rehearsal room with the stories.
it was pretty hilarious, I'm going to say.
When Richard worked for us a couple of times, you know, we have to add extra time onto the things because the stories would come up. And of course, a lot of singers of the generation, the people that work for me, want to hear the stories. So,
of course. Like,
okay, let's do that.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, Copley's the same. I mean, it makes me laugh so much, John.
Yeah.
It makes me laugh so much. So you do that. That's an amazing work experience. Did it click then? I can be a singer, or what did you want to be when you were a kid?
No, that came a lot later. I originally, I guess, not to my shame, but to my chagrin, I guess, I wanted to be a lawyer and go into politics. And then I started working for some politicians and went, oh no, I really don't want to do that.
Did you actually do that?
Yeah, I did. I was at University of Sydney and I was interning to the Shadow Attorney General of New South Wales at the time. And I just met politicians and went, yeah, that's really, really not me, I'm afraid. and all the whole time, even at university, studying economics and law and all sorts of other stuff, I was involved in at least two musical society and or light opera companies in Sydney, doing small roles, rehearsal, piano playing, conducting stuff, you know, was, you know, these sort of amateur places or at least semi-professional where you do a role and you might get $500 for a major role. So I was playing rehearsal piano for a lot of them.
You were doing that, were you?
Yeah, conducting. I conducted a whole run of Chicago with a musical society. Played a lot of rehearsal piano. Did a lot of, you know, like minor roles and stuff. And then in 1991 or 92 maybe, I did. I jumped in. God, I was singing Gaston in Traviata at Rockdale Opera Company. And the guy who was singing, Alfredo, something happened. I don't know what happened, but a week before the thing, they said, and I said, could you learn it? They called me on a Saturday, said, could you learn it? And the shows were Thursday and Friday night. I don't know. And the lady who was singing Traviata, her name will come to me, said, why don't you come to my place on Sunday and I'll teach it to you. Mm-hmm. And I did that on all day Sunday, and I took my teacher on the Monday afternoon. And by Wednesday night, I was staging it, and Thursday and Friday I'd opened.
Wow.
You know, I think because I was way too young and way too inexperienced to think that was a really, really difficult thing to do. You know, when you're young and stupid, you say, oh, yeah, shit, I'll do that. Yeah, oh, yeah.
I think there's a lot of that, Stuart, with the bravery that youth gives you, that you're not, you know, people doing that in their 40s that were pros would worry about it much more. When you're young, you just go, oh.
And the weird thing is, over time, I've thought about it. I'm not sure it was brave. I think it was just lack of awareness. I think it was lack of oh sure, okay, how hard can it be? I'm glad I don't have to do it now. That's all I can tell you. But and that sort of set my path. And then not long after that, I left Australia to study conducting full-time in the US. And while I was doing that, I got recruited into the voice department, and the rest is history.
Right, that's a big change then at that point. Was leaving Australia difficult? Was that a big difficult choice?
Not really. I mean, it was certain the point where, I mean, there were a lot of competitions, Stetford, though, and really well-endowed competition prizes in Australia. And at that stage, I'd probably won most of them. Right. And it was getting to the point where it was a bit like, you've got to get your business done or get off the pot, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And then this opportunity to study in the US came up. And I had a scholarship. I had scholarship money under my bursary money under my belt. I went, it's if I don't do it now, it will never happen. I'll chicken out.
Yeah.
So I went, and you know, it all sort of took. It took me the 2.5 years of grad school, but it all everything slotted in. And then I went to the Young Artists Program in San Francisco, and then it was the die was cast at that point.
Right. What was the sort of regime like in that sort of learning department, the voice department there now in San Francisco?
Well, in San Francisco, the Young Artist Program, there's two separate versions of it. There's the Merrill Program, which is named after the guy who started San Francisco, by Gaetano Merrill. And that's a 10-week summer program. And in the 10 weeks, this invited singers from American universities and around the place get invited, and in five weeks, they put up, rehearse and produce one. And then in the second 5 weeks, they rehearse and produce a second, which they then, at the time, used to take on tour around the US.
Right.
And that's what I did. Out of that Merrill program of 10 weeks, the Opera House then invites a small handful, you know, three or four singers every year to be a part of their two-year resident artist program kind of thing at San Francisco. And I was one of the singers. John Relier came through that year. I think the thing mostly, obviously, we were, to a certain extent, we were there to sing all of the Compra Mario stuff.
Yeah.
And where appropriate, cover the big things, or at least second cover the big things in the house, which actually meant that all the boys in the program in the 2 years I was there, we sang in every opera in the season for two seasons. There was not one opera we weren't in the 22 operas in 2 years.
Wow.
11 operas a year, because there's always male Compra Mario stuff that you can do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and some of the times while covering some of the bigger stuff and going out at 8 o'clock in the morning and doing outreach shows at primary schools and fundraising concerts at lunchtime. And, you know, we certainly earned our money.
Yeah.
But then every day you're in rehearsal, you're working with Nello Santi or Donald Runicles or Bonning or Patrick Summers or all of these. And then that's just in the pit. Then you've got Graham Vick. And on stage, you've got Tom Hampson and Ruth Ann Swenson and Renee Fleming and Ben Heppner. And
incredible. You know. Yeah. Sure, you know, I think we've talked about this in late night chats in various cities, but I think that also the thing about that point in a career, and obviously we look back on that as a hectic schedule by any stretch of the imagination, but as well as the expertise you're surrounded by, the sheer stage time is a thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Young artists, getting on stage and seeing how that goes.
Yeah, you're getting on stage and learning for yourself how you relate to that and how you pace yourself on a daily basis. Yeah.
Pace is a big one, isn't it? Pacing is a massive one.
And then being on stage and watching the real masters and watching what they do and what they don't do, what bits, you know, in the first week of a couple of weeks of rehearsal, which parts they don't really do yet because they know they've got a run of seven performances to do, all of which are the focal point. Yeah. So watching where they rest and where they don't rest, where they take their time. And that was a remarkable thing to watch, particularly when, you know, watching Ben Heppner sing Lohengrin with Carita Mattila and Jan-Hendrik Rudering, and was, you know, watching in rehearsal which bits they always sang every time and which bits they sang every second rehearsal.
Yeah.
Like, okay, take that away. There's something in that.
Yeah.
And that was invaluable. That's the sort of experience that the learning curve, and the learning curve is steep.
Yeah.
But all good learning curves are.
Well, they are. But also, that's the thing about good artists, even in the early part of their career. You obviously are aware enough to bother to look at those
Well, I just figured I was a little bit older than a lot of my colleagues. They'd come through American bachelor's programs as musicians and singers, and I hadn't. So I had a little bit of catching up to do. I was a little bit older because I'd actually worked for a living for a couple of years before going to grad school. So I thought I had probably had time to make up a little bit. So, and then of course you've got guys like Ben Heppner, particularly, I know his name, and Richard Margeson, who were incredibly generous with their time if you asked them.
Yeah.
If you went to them and said, listen, I know you're very busy, da-da-da-da, but is there a time after rehearsal one afternoon where you and I could sit down and buy you a coffee or buy you a bottle of red wine, or I don't care, buy you whatever, your poison of choice, and we can sit and talk? And there were people who were always, always ready to do that. You know,
I think I've got this. I've been talking about it a lot this week in the state. We're talking at the moment. We're talking in February 21. I've been saying that a lot this week, that there's one of the many cliches about our business. And I don't get into cliches too much. In fact, whenever I'm asked about elitism in interviews, I refuse to answer the question. You know, so I should, you know, shut up. I'm not answering it, because by me answering it, it's carrying on the conversation, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah.
But there's a lot of myths, and one of the myths has really, for me anyway, has been smashed out of the water this year. Is that sort of cliche of the flakiness of artists being flaky. This year, artists have been, if they're doing jobs driving vans, if they've been learning things, putting stuff online, they have been resilient as hell and imaginative. And unfortunately, a lot of people in other areas of the business, it is a creative industry, that have not been like that as much.
Yeah.
You know, what can we do now? Artists have been there. And the other thing I was going to say that was related to what you were saying is that people in good positions, if they're good, they want to share experience. They want to help young artists coming through. Absolutely.
I agree. Well, I mean, I would never say to anyone that it's a duty to do so, because that is only true for some people.
Yeah.
Some people feed desperately, really believe in wanting to take it the next generation. But at some level, if none of us do, then who does?
Yeah.
You know, and it's not, for me, it's never been like, oh, you must. And if you don't want to, that makes you less of a, it doesn't.
No,
some people who, and there are some people who know in their own hearts that they're not cut out for that. And that, I get that. I would much rather the people who know that they really don't want to teach to not.
Yeah.
Because.
I think, Stuart, don't you think though, because I have this thing about, my job as a producer, that sometimes it's not only about teaching or even watching people do it. It's just about an occasional word sometimes, and it's not necessarily a teaching thing as such. It's that you learn from them because they're good and they've got the experience. You know, I've got a, I don't know if you know this guy, but there's a producer in the sort of 50s in the UK called Binky Beaumont. He was like,
yeah, of course, yeah,
big producer. And I think, in my own little way, I'm absolutely part of that line. There's a family tree of professions that is passed on. It runs through you. And I read his biography a few years ago. There's so many of the problems I have to deal with now. They're the same things. The things don't go away. It's about, with singers, it's about preparation. It's about which roles taken at the right or wrong time. Pacing yourself, as you say, you know, and all that. So sometimes it's just good to talk to people and they can just go, maybe not now. And, and having that bit of advice, that's enough.
I've got to say, some of the most direct advice, the most useful advice, has always come in the most, in quite a not confrontational, but in the most direct way. You know, when I've genuinely had a question, I'm young, I've been offered X, and this would be a really big step in a direction from which there is no return, you know? And I was living in Australia at the time, where I was in Australia for about 12 months. And I was living in Australia and I got offered at all of 28 years of age, I would have been 29 at the time when it happened, to sing my first Lohengrin.
Right.
And I went, oh my God, you know, that's, I'm not qualified to make that decision. And I called my singing teacher in the US, picked the right time, and said, this is what's going on. I've been offered this. And she said, is it a long rehearsal period? I said, yes, 7 weeks. Okay. Is it a new production? Yes. Is it an A orchestra? We're in Germany. So yes, it's an A orchestra. How big is the house? 1,000 seats. Is the conductor super experienced? I said, yes. She said, are they paying you? And I said, yes. She said, then hang up the phone and tell them yes.
It's good advice, though.
You know, but she obviously had a set of checklist in her head.
I think that's right.
Are you jumping in? Is it a conductor that's maybe doing it for the first time? Is it a 4,000 seat auditorium? You know, yeah. She checked, yeah. Bang, 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 bang. And she said, yeah. Then you need to hang up the phone to me. You need to call them back and tell them yes.
Yeah, I think it's a very good set of questions. And I think because I think, you know, it's none of these things are facts or anything that you and I think, you know, we're chatting away, is that you often... The decisions that you make as a singer to not take a role are as important or sometimes more important than the ones you do take.
Absolutely. No question. I waited till 2016. Well, I waited 2014 to answer the question. I waited until 2016 for it to actually happen, to sing Tristan.
Right.
And my agent and I've been with the same agent forever, and he's very much one of those guys who is all about what you say no to and when is equally as important as what you say yes to. Yeah. He's never been a booking agent. He's been an agent that really plans every step in conjunction with you. He's always saying, what do you think? This is the, and he said, the Tristan question keeps coming up, you know. He said, we need to establish our ground rules between you and me. Mm-hmm. About what constitutes the word yes. And he said, let me start. Or I said, I think it needs to be a conductor that you really trust is going to really be aware of the fact that it's your first time around.
Yeah.
Okay. It needs to be a long rehearsal period. It needs to be a new production. It needs to be an orchestra that you really want to do it with. And it needs to be with at least your Isolde colleague that you feel 100% simpatico with in terms of they're going to respect the fact that it's your first time and all that sort of stuff. And then we went, okay, that's our baseline. When the first one comes in that crosses all those off the list, I guess that's the first time that they say yes. And then the Berlin Philharmonic and Simon Rattle and the Baden-Baden Easter Festival and Nina Stemmer come along and I went, oh, shit, okay, that's the list right there, isn't it? It's like, all right. And Nina's done like 100 of the bloody things. So she knew that, I mean, I knew that even in the rehearsal process, and Simon had, I would work with Simon at the Berlin Philharmonic and he had sort of floated the idea at me and I didn't really sort of attach anything to it. It was just, you know, we're just two guys having a beer after a concert.
Yeah.
And when it came, I went, oh, okay. And he was... Well, you know the guy, even if you know him only by reputation, you know what a giving musician and human being is. And to do that with a long rehearsal period in a new production with the Berlin Philharmonic and Simon and the cast of Death was literally, I'd run out of reasons to say no.
Yeah, interesting. Sure, can I ask you something? Because I understand, I might feel stupid in a second. I understand every single one of those questions and I'd have asked the same things. Apart from the new production bit, why the new production? Is that a good thing in that context?
It generally means that you've got a longer rehearsal process.
Right. Okay. Fine.
Sure. If it's a Vita, particularly if it's a German opera house or a German concert hall, if it's not a new production, everyone else might be coming back to it, and you'll get 2 weeks.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely.
The new production thing, the long rehearsal period and new production answer the same question. Sorry.
Yeah. Right. Very, very good. It leads nicely onto something that I was going to ask you anyway. You know, obviously now you're the top of your game and everything. You're known for all of these, you know, massive roles. You know, as I say, all the Wagners, Peter Grimes and everything. Now, with those, obviously, you've worked a decent amount of time. You've worked your way through and everything.
Mm.
Those sort of roles, there comes a responsibility because they're the big ones, you know, they're the ones people come to see. How difficult a process was that for you to get into your head that is, you know, because there's no point in me saying, oh, it's pressure, because you know it's pressure, you know, but how easy was that for you to get used to having that pressure of you're doing the biggest roles in the opera repertoire, you're doing them regularly? Was that an easy psychological thing for you?
No, it's a really good question. It wasn't, and it's still not. Tristan certainly was another level of Everest, you know, compared to both Valkyrie and Parsifal, which at the time I thought were was a lot to do, you know. And then, of course, you know, I opened the score to Tristan and went, "What the hell have I done?" You know, you open Act Three and you're like, "Does he ever shut up? Does he stop singing ever?" Like, apparently not. So, but it's interesting because every now and then, particularly before 2020, when everything was stacked on top of one another all the time, you know, because when you're busy, you feel like everything's working and running, and somebody offers you something and you've got a spot for it, you say yes, you know. So, but I found myself occasionally in over between late 17 and about halfway through 2019, wondering if there wasn't a role in an opera somewhere where I didn't have the title.
You know,
singing Macduff and Macbeth, just because it's beautiful singing, and you know, you don't have to carry the damn show.
I mean, that's what I mean with the question. Really, I think it's a difficult one. I mean, I remember years ago, Mark Stone was singing on Yehin for me, and Graham Broadbent was singing Graham, and do the curtain calls, and you know, Graham gets this amazing cheer, and I remember Mark, you know, not as politely as this, saying, "I've been on here all night and you've come on and done that 5 minutes and got that massive cheer," because there's a lot less pressure on it. Okay, it's pressure because it's 6 minutes or whatever, you have to deliver it, but it's not the same as being on there all night. It just isn't. And that's what intrigued me, because you go from, you don't go and do Macduff, you go from Tristan to Rhymes, and that's a, do you have to pace yourself mentally for those as well as physically?
I do now. I didn't. Even, I'm going to say even 5 years ago, I didn't have to as much as I do now. I went into Tristan knowing that there would be some compromises that would need to be made because of what it was in terms of the physical amount of stamina required. And I knew that over time, Tristan was going to force me to make compromises in other things. And that meant at some point leaving some roles behind. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but it's gonna, I get that at some point, there'll be roles that I just really won't be able to sensibly, in any good conscience, say to an opera house, "Yes, I'm ready to come and do that." When I think, you know, probably not anymore. So I've had to be a little bit more careful about that in the last, I guess 4 or 5 years.
Right.
Just because, you know, just because of the mileage, I think, to a certain extent, the wear and tear, so to speak, you know.
And of course, but there's pressure in vocally and psychologically and everything. But I think when you get something like a Grimes, for example, that you've done a lot of times now, you know, I've seen you do it once and possibly twice, I think, but you know, a lot of people think that you are this generation's Grimes. That's I think that's an absolutely fair observation. Coming back to roles when you've had a big success, is that tough or is that easier? You go, "I've done this, I know I can do it, it's easier going again," or is it different looking at it again?
It's both. It's mentally a comfort, because you know that even if it's been a little while since you've looked at it, that it's somewhere in there, and your muscles, your body will remember it. So there's a little bit of comfort of like, oh, I don't have to start completely from scratch from this thing and put everything back into my head, because a lot of it's still there. Sometimes you spend a couple of days finding the strands in different parts of storage and then putting the strands together. That only takes a couple of days.
Beautifully put, yeah.
But the pressure is, particularly with Grimes, I know, and I feel this with Grimes and Valkyra both, is that when I'm on stage with Zygmunt or Grimes now, there is, whether I like it or not, there's an expectation.
Yeah.
And that's only reasonable. I mean, I totally understand that. But that means that I put extra pressure on myself to make sure that in the process of getting from first day of rehearsal to a new performance of it, that I have never been lazy, because you can be. If you know something really well, you can kind of just rock up and do your Grimes or your Valkyra, you know? Yeah, and that would be easy, but I just think, I've said this about so much, but the stuff that I sing, particularly Tristan, Parsifal, Grimes, Fidelio, Valkyra, is that this is, at least for me, the pinnacle of Western art and music combined, which means you have a certain responsibility to the people who are paying really dearly a lot of the time to sit for three or four or five hours and really be drawn into the story. It's our responsibility to make sure that every time we do that, we find it interesting and engaging for us as performers, because I firmly believe that if we can find a role or every phrase or every interaction with other people on stage, if we can find a reason as performers to be engaged in that moment as it happens, then we've got a much better chance of bringing the audience along with us.
Well said.
You know what I mean? And to the point where with Grimes, you've got, and when he does that final scene, you've got to bring as many of the audience as you can with you, and you won't get everyone, you know, but as many as you can bring, and you've got to stand on the edge of the abyss that he is looking into, and you've got to force them to look into it while you jump. Now, they'd have to jump with you. They can stand there and look on horrified as you jump into the abyss, but they have to stand on the edge of that cliff and look into that abyss with you while you jump off. And that's the challenge for us, but that's the real joy in bringing the audience with you and bringing them to the point where their breath stops and their heart stops and they think, he's not going to jump, is he? And then watching them as you jump and they go, no. You know,
I couldn't, beautifully put, Stuart. I think that the thing for me is, I say a lot about, you know, particularly we'll talk about this in a minute about this recent times, but you know, we're under a lot of pressure, but I really believe, I think this is a bit of Jean Cain thing about you know, pressure is a privilege. You know, if you're in a position where you're pressured, there'll be a lot of people that would like to be in that position for that job, that thing. And so take it, you know, take the pressure and say, okay, how do we deal with it now? I mean, we all have times where we can't deal with it. Obviously, that's just, anyone that
that's
says-
why, that's why we have vodka.
But it's right, that's I think that's the thing, that you just cannot deal with everything all the time. And suddenly you go, okay, well, right this moment. But you can deal with that pressure to go, okay, I'm pressured. But then again, the pressure that you have, as you rightly acknowledge, is that people now go and see again, he's going to be good. So I know this about you, because you're like me. You know, the biggest critic we're going to get is ourselves anyway.
Oh, every time. So, oh, awful. I'm like the most self-sabotaging human on the planet.
But anyway, so moving on now, obviously the last 18 months, well, last year has been pretty disaster for everyone. Obviously jobs cancelled and stuff like that. How has that been personally for you in that period?
It's been hard. Just watching watching a whole year just, and not all at once, crumble before your eyes. And then there was a little bit of hope for a couple of weeks, and then that crumbled. And then there was hope for a couple of weeks, and then it crumbled. And it was sort of the build up to, oh, maybe we've turned the corner to another 3 months of nothing. But in all of that, in the 12 months, March 13 was the last thing I did at the beginning of the whole process. There are two or three places that, despite the difficulties, went out of their way to make things work. Not in the way that they planned to make them work, surely, but they said, well, what can we do to keep some of this alive, albeit in a truncated or reduced orchestration form or whatever it was, to do that? And there have been, at least personally for me, there have been a couple of places that have gone out of their way to make things work that it would have been easier, and I would have completely understood had the management of those particular institutions gone, you know, it's all just going to be a little too hard. And there were a couple of places, Dallas Symphony in September of last year, and then the opera company on Oviedo at the end of last year for Fidelio, where they said, whatever hoop they give us to jump through, we'll jump through it. Will you be flexible with us and jump through them with us? And everyone went, absolutely we will.
Yeah,
because we've been through what you're being through. You're being told that you can't open, and you have to tell the people that you can't that we can't perform. I mean, who the hell wants to pass that message on?
No. I mean, it's difficult. I mean, I've been saying a lot to my own team as well as other people and supporters, whatever. The thing is now that obviously we don't want this to be the case, but it is that everything's changed. The whole ecosystem has changed. And yeah.
Absolutely.
And we have to grab it now and say, okay, well, we're going to do this. And, you know, I've been saying this a lot this week about every ism is now a wasm. There's nothing yeah, that is.
I agree.
And if there's something that we look at, you know, we're looking at things this year and you go, well, would we have considered that in a normal time? Absolutely not. Are we considering it now? Damn right we are. You know, if we can give freelancers work, if we can give audiences something to see, we'll do it.
Yeah, I agree. I've got a mate of mine who has been quite successful in tech startup kind of stuff for a little while. Now lives in Las Vegas and does whatever the hell he wants, basically. And he's been a very driven kind of guy. He's had a goal and nothing got in his way. I mean, and to his credit, he's really been incredibly successful at it. And he deserves the success. And, you know, he and I talk quite a lot. We've been mates since we were 12. And I was talking to him and said, you know, I'm thinking, you know, maybe looking at this avenue and this avenue and this avenue. And he says, mate, in 2020, all bets are off. There is nothing that I wouldn't consider.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, even guys who know, like, you know, I'm prepared to blinker and get it, whatever I need to get done, I'm going to get done. He's like, dude, in 2020...
Yeah, I mean, people are saying to me certain things, which I won't go into now, but then some, you know, the normal is different because we wouldn't have said we can't see families at Christmas. You've got to worry about when you go to a supermarket. You can't go for a walk for an hour or whatever. So with all those things in, whether we do normal things within an opera company is completely gone. You know, it's
exactly. Yeah.
But on a happier note, I know this now, but explain to our listeners, you know, you are working at the moment, you're in Berlin. I'm talking to you in Berlin at the moment. What are you doing there?
We had originally a run of six performances of a new production of Janáček at the Berlin State Opera, conducted by Simon Rattle.
It's not so bad. It's not a shabby job, that, is it?
Yeah, I've got to say, it could have been a lot worse. I mean, it's an amazing cast, and it's the Berlin State Opera, and they're an incredible orchestra. And we got here with full of beans and benevolence and really full of positivity. And everything started on at 11 o'clock on the first day, no questions asked. Da-da-da-da-da. And at the end of that first week, the management came down and said, listen, we've just heard from the health ministry that we won't be allowed to reopen the theatre until after the 21st of March. So our run of performances, which was going to end on the 27th of February, is gone. We are going to do one performance, the opening night, which was scheduled for February 14th. What says Valentine's better than infanticide, you know? we're going to have on the February the 14th. And we will stream it. But at the end, after that first performance, we will pay you for the performance and everyone will go home because we just can't, we're not allowed to put any performance on. And that we, of course, it all sort of a bit of a blood of the gut, but not unexpected, you know? And they were incredibly tactful in handling it. And, you know, they really were quite sensitive in the whole process. Mm-hmm. Turns out that we've moved it by a day because it's going to be broadcast on one of the television stations here, Dreisat, Satellite 3.
Yeah.
And they are better placed with cameras and sound equipment and all that sort of stuff on the 13th of February. So we're actually doing it in the theatre on the 13th of February. And then there's I think we go up at 3 o'clock. I think the show goes up at 8. So there's some hours then in there for them to take good camera angles and all that sort of stuff for the actual broadcast. And then we all go home
that night, aren't they?
Yeah, it goes out the same day.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, obviously it's disappointing to have a run of, after so many cancellations, to have something that was just full of positivity to, again, be struck down by that. But to have one performance and the house be extremely accommodating in very sensitive about how they dealt with it was as good as anyone could have asked for at that point.
Yeah, that's great to hear.
These opera houses, as funded as they are by their government, there's a level at which that you just really can't do it forever, you know.
No. Well, it's great that it's going on at some level, and obviously there's a recording of it, so we should be able to see it at some point. And you're in Berlin at the moment. What is Berlin like at the moment? In London, it's pretty much locked down. What are you?
Berlin is completely closed. The only thing that are open, only things that are open, are supermarkets and places where you can get stuff that you can either have delivered or take away. You can't sit down anywhere. And everything else is shut.
Yeah, it's like here. How was the rehearsal period for that? What was it like, the lockdown situation there? Were you rehearsing fairly normally or so?
Yeah, we were rehearsing pretty normally. I mean, there were some restrictions on how many people we could have in the room at the time. Yeah. We were rehearsing with masks as soon as you weren't singing. There's 1.5 meters between everyone, even in the performance, there's 1.5 meters. And because the rehearsal room isn't the same size as the stage or the theater, we were, every time you had, if you had like supers, you know, the extras, supers in the show, then we had to get out of the room, or whoever wasn't required had to be out of the room. And then every time they had a 20 minute break, all the windows had to be open and we all had to leave. You couldn't sort of sit in the room for 20 minutes, you had to bugger off, which is fine, you know. And they were doing all of the, you know, they were doing all the things. They've got places to put sanitizer on your hands every 5 feet, give or take a bit. And they really are taking quite seriously. And that's sort of what I mean about these, but the places that have said, well, whatever we need to do to make it work, we're going to make it work. And we're going to ask you to be flexible enough that, you know, you're going to have to wear a mask in the room unless you're singing. Even in the room, when you're not singing with masks on, you can't be closer than 1.5 meters, you know. Then we just went, well, if that's what it takes to get the show up and running, then that's what it takes. That's fine.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to hearing all about that when you open. What we're talking now, we're talking on the 3rd of Feb. So, you know, another 10 days to go. And I hope that rest of it goes well. Stu, I'm going to let you go. I can't wait until, in whatever city in the world, we are sitting down with an old-fashioned, putting the entire bloody world to
rights. We are hoping to be in London in late July this year.
Wow.
Just for fun.
Well, good. I mean, I remember some of my favourite conversations about our industry have been in late night areas where there's an old fashioned going around. We said, let's have another one, and I think we can sort that problem out.
I think if we open another bottle of rye whiskey, and we could probably fix that problem.
But Stu, it's a pleasure.
What a pleasure, James.
To know you, mate, and really doing incredible work. And always, we talked to everyone about artists putting back in. You've always put back in.
I love it. I really do love watching the next generation take the torch and run with it and succeed. You know, it's just, it really makes me happy.
Have a great show next week, and I'll see you very soon.
Talk to you soon, mate. What a pleasure.
Yeah, cheers. See
you later. Bye.
You have been listening to From the Producer's Office, a series of informal podcasts with James Clutton. For more information on Opera Holland Park, please visit www.operahollandpark.com.